This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
Cancer is a word that immediately changes the tone of any conversation. Almost anyone, everyone, has been touched in some way, whether it's personally, through family, somebody close, and yet despite how common it is, there is still a lot of fear, confusion, and misinformation around it. We hear about prevention, early detection, treatment breakthroughs, but what does this actually mean for you? Today, on the Weekly Checkup, with me and Dr. Anton Myberg, we're cutting through some of that noise. It's not about panic or false hope, it's just a practical conversation. Dr. Anton Myberg, a very, very good evening. I hope you're well.
Well, thanks, and you. We're in for an interesting chat tonight.
Yeah, it's actually not an easy one because it comes with, I mean, I remember as a kid, you didn't even tell people. I remember one of my mother's close friends passed away, and until the day she died, I don't think they even told her, the family, that she actually had cancer.
I don't think cancer was a good word in those days. Not that it's a good word now, but it's more understandable now, and people catch it much quicker when they screen for it, so they understand that it's easier to treat, etc. But in those days, there was no treatment, there was no outcome. Things were very different.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. This is a pre-record, but please send your questions anyway, 061-895-1019. Starting at the beginning, what actually is cancer?
So cancer is a large group of diseases that occur when some of the body's cells begin to grow and divide uncontrollably. Normally, human cells grow and multiply, and they needed to replace old or damaged cells that die. Cancer comes along and disrupts this orderly process, causing abnormal cells to survive when they should die and new cells to form when they aren't needed. And the characteristics of cancer are based on tumor formation. Many cancers form solid masses called tumors, which can be benign, in other words, not cancer, or malignant, which is cancerous. Get things called metastases, where your malignant tumors can invade nearby tissue and spread to distant parts of the body through the blood or the lymphatic system. And then on a genetic basis, cancer is a genetic disease caused by changes or mutations to DNA that controls how cells function, grow, and divide. And there are major types of cancers. There's over 100 different types of cancers, usually named after the organ or tissue where they originate. So carcinomas, those are the most common type, starting in the skin or the tissues that line the internal organs, example, breast, lung, and colon. Sarcomas, those are cancers that form in the bone and the soft tissue, including muscle, fat, and blood vessels. In leukemias, cancer of the blood-forming tissue in the bone marrow that generally do not form solid tumors. And then lymphomas and myelomas, which are cancers that begin in the cells of the immune system. And whilst most cancers result from genetic mutations over a lifetime, 5 to 10% of them are inherited from parents.
Okay, and what causes a body to suddenly start producing these abnormal cells?
So when the body's natural regulatory system for cell growth failed due to an accumulation of genetic errors or mutations, then cancer is proliferative. While it seems sudden, these abnormal cells develop through multi-step processes of changes that eventually break the cell's internal control manual. And the root cause is generally your genetic mutations. So every cell has a nucleus containing DNA. This acts as an instruction manual for when a cell should grow, divide, or die. Cancer starts when this manual is damaged, and you get things like DNA replication errors, where your body produces billions of new cells every day, and there are random typos that can occur when copying DNA. Could be from environmental damage like UV radiation from the sun, cigarette smoke, or alcohol, or inherited risks where we said 5 to 50% of individuals are born with faulty pages. And now you get a failure of safety mechanisms. So normally the body has a checkpoint to catch and fix these errors. Cancer cells survive because they manage to disable three critical defenses. And those are your brake system, which is called tumor suppression, where your mutations disable genes. You get self-destruction, a term called apoptosis. When the cell is too damaged to fix, it's supposed to commit suicide, but cancer cells ignore the signal and keep living. And then you get immune evasion, where the cancer cells hide from the immune system by reducing the markers on the surface that would normally flag them for destruction. And you get a shift to an uncontrolled growth. So once these systems or these safety systems fail, the cell stops following its normal role and enters a state of permanent rapid division.
Is cancer one disease, or is it different diseases?
So cancer is defined as a large group of diseases, more than 100 different types of diseases.
Right.
They are commonly characteristic due to uncontrolled growth and ability of its spread, as we said earlier, metastases.
Right.
And each different cancer behaves uniquely based on its own genetic makeup. So it's considered many diseases because of the origin and type. For instance, we said carcinoma could be found in the breast, could be found in the lung, can be found in the solid organs, whereas a sarcoma is found in the bone, or a leukemia is found in the bone marrow. And it's dependent on the person's genetic profile. Every cancer has a different, unique combination of genetic mutations, and that's very important. So two people with the same type of cancer, example, breast cancer, can have different molecular drivers that are promoting their cancer growth. And cancers grow at different rates. They respond to different types of treatments. So, for instance, back to breast cancer, hormone treatment could be highly effective for many breast cancers, but it's not used for lung cancer, so which is typically treated with chemotherapy or lung surgery. So each one is different. So that one disease perspective is no longer something we refer to, because we've got to say that cancer is a multitude of diseases. And a recent proposal in one of the Nature journals actually said that we should argue against this, and we should get a unified sort of definition of cancer. And they want to call it a disease of uncontrolled proliferation of your cells, which are subjected to evolution by natural selection.
Because that's your common thread, isn't it? That cells, the wrong cells are growing uncontrollably and
Right,
you can't stop
but
them.
what's the cause? And that's the point here. Is it genetic? Is it radiation? Is it environmental? Is it a typo in your DNA? So, and that also makes a big difference
To how
falling
you treat
into
it,
how you
I
treat that. So
imagine.
ultimately, your targeted therapy, it's all designed, it's a single battle that's not won with one cure.
Right. And before we go to a break, or our first break, why does it feel like cancer is much more common today? Is it more common?
It's more common because we're diagnosing it at a higher rate than ever before due to better screening and due
Right.
to better pickup. So in 2022, there were 20 million cases of cancer worldwide, and they estimate by 2050 there'll be 35 million cases of cancer. So the surge that we've seen in cancer is definitely a combination of better technology, changing lifestyle, demographic shifts. Also, we've got a longer life expectancy. So one of the biggest risk factors for cancer is aging. Cancer occurs when there's genetic mutations in our DNA, when it's accumulated cells over time. So the older ones gets, the more we get mutations in these cells. And in fact, more than 50% of our global cases of cancer occur in people over the age of 65. We've also got much better detection and screening. There's widespread screening, there's programs always for breast cancer, for prostate cancer, for colorectal cancers. We've got much more sophisticated technology with MRI scans, CAT scans, PET scans, and it's easier to pick cancer up from earlier diagnoses, which is very good because it leads to lower mortality rates. So we also got to understand that there's a higher uptake in cancer because of people's environmental issues such as obesity, processed diets, sedentary lifestyles, environmental factors. And the last thing is because of better reporting. So people report cancers earlier and
Right.
better.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you just after this. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. Send us your questions, 061-895-1019.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. This evening, we are talking about cancer. Not an easy conversation at all. It's just one that, I don't know, we seem to be programmed to be a little bit more uncomfortable about. We've spoken about what cancer is and why it feels like more people are suffering from cancer at the moment. But now what we want to try and do is understand the risks. Who gets cancer and why? So I guess the question, the fundamental question is cancer genetic or is it lifestyle or none of the above?
So it's both, but the genetic causes are about 5 to 10% of your cases, and lifestyle is about 90 to 95% of lifestyle choices, environmental factors, and random cellular errors that occur over a person's lifetime. So whilst if you really want to break down the risk, well, all cancer is actually genetic in the sense that it involves a change to your DNA, the cause of those changes are significantly different because you get inheritance and you get lifestyle. So inheritance, we said, is 5 to 10%, and then people have all heard about BRCA genes. That's one of the most common things in breast and ovarian cancers in females and can be in males. Lifestyle environment, 90 to 95% of people's cancers are caused by this. And this is a mutation that's acquired during your lifestyle. And that could be from tobacco use, where you get 25 to 30% of cancer deaths, diet and obesity, 30 to 35%, and other factors like infections, physical inactivity, and excessive alcohol use or exposure. And lastly, there's something called bad luck, where some of the mutations are simply random copying errors and that occurred.
So what are the biggest risk factors? I'm going to say that people ignore, but I don't know if they do ignore them or not. What are the biggest risk factors that you see maybe in your practice?
So I think the strongest independent risk factor is age. Despite
Well, that's a bit annoying, considering there's nothing we can do about that.
Well, you just can't don't get
Well,
older.
yeah, it kind of defeats the
Longevity,
purpose.
you know. So it's the single most independent strong risk factor for cancer, but only about 40% of people actually recognize this. And this is due to cumulative damage. As we age, our cells accumulate more DNA, and they get more mutations, and then the body's natural repair mechanisms become less effective. And the median age for defining or for diagnosing cancer is about 66 years old. Secondly, obesity and body weight. Obesity is associated with at least 13 types of cancers, and that excess fat causes chronic low-level inflammation and produces high levels of estrogen and insulin, which can promote cancer growth. And this is an emerging threat, but experts suggest that obesity will soon overtake smoking as the leading preventable cause of cancer, unless people get onto the GLP-1s and all these other things that can prevent these from happening. And of course, alcohol consumption. Many people think that moderate drinking is not a cancer risk, but it actually is, because even a light intake of alcohol can increase the risk of breast and esophageal cancers, because when the body breaks down alcohol, ethanol, it creates something called acetaldehyde, which is a carcinogen that damages your DNA and its proteins. And you get a multiplying effect in the risk of mouth and throat cancer significantly higher for those who drink and use tobacco. And then we get the hidden things like radon gas, which is an invisible, odorless gas that can seep into homes from soil that can cause lung cancers. You get physical inactivity, which is approximately causing about 5% of cancers due to sedentary lifestyle. And then chronic infections, viruses like HPV, human papillomavirus, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C are responsible for about 10 to 30% of your cancers worldwide. And UV exposure beyond the beach, if you are just exposed to UV all the time, especially on cloudy days in the winter, these are very much causative of cancer. And highly processed and cured meats, these
It
contribute to
seems that
35%
when
of
you list
cancer.
all of these things, I mean, we could try and be careful, but it feels like it's quite difficult
It's a
to
lot.
avoid. Yeah, I mean, can there just be bad luck?
There's definitely a chance of bad luck. Some people where they just get a random change in mutation, definitely. But for instance, not everyone who gets HPV or human papillomavirus will get cancer. Not everyone who gets hepatitis B and C will get cancer, but they've got a 30% chance of getting it. So rather get vaccinated against these things. So there are things. Cured meats, don't have meat more than once or twice a week. And if you do have meat, careful of charcoal grilling meat all the time, because these are cause heterocyclic amines, which are carcinogens, to come in your body and cause cancer, cause like things like bacon and ham, which is not really a problem, thank God. These cause nitrites and nitrates in the body, which also can transform in mutagenic types of destruction of the cells. So these environmental factors play a very, very big role.
If someone in your family has cancer, how worried or had cancer, how worried should we be?
So we've said that about 5 to 10% of all cancers are truly hereditary, meaning that they're caused by a gene mutation that you have passed on from got passed on from a
So
parent.
that's the well-known BRCA
Yeah, the
gene.
BRCAs, that type. So,
What else?
but most cancers are sporadic, and they result from aging, lifestyle, or environmental factors. But when should you be more worried about it? It's when you've got a strong family history, which typically involves things like cancer was diagnosed at a very young age in a close relative, like a parent or a sibling or a child who's been diagnosed before the age of 50. Or if they're
So before the age of 50, right?
clusters in the family, multiple blood relatives on the same side of the family having the same related cancer, like breast cancer, then you look for things, or ovarian cancer, then you look for things like BRCA genes, that type of thing. Or multiple cancers, someone in the family having multiple cancers, there's a high risk factor. And you've got to evaluate your risk by gathering your details, trying to find out the specific type of cancer that your relative has had, and then speaking to your doctor and sharing the information. And if there's a pattern, you even speak to a genetic counselor to get an understanding and explain if genetic testing is necessary.
What's interesting, or maybe what's worrying for me, is maybe, I don't know, how long have we known about the BRCA gene? Let's say 20 years, 30 years. Before that, yes, obviously, if there was a large propensity of breast cancer in the family, you'd think it's genetic. But we don't know what we don't know. In other words, pancreatic cancer or one of those that we don't think is clearly genetic, maybe we will find still that it is.
Very possible. As you say, we're advancing at a rapid rate in science. So we're picking up new things as we go along. And I mean, with all the new testing, with all the liquid biopsies, with all the different types of scans and available modalities to check for these things, we will find new things going forward.
And maybe new causes. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. This evening, we're talking about cancer. We'll be back with you just after the break. Welcome back to the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg talking about cancer. Let us have your questions. 061-895-1019. This is a pre-record. And it's actually a pre-record because this evening is Anton Myberg's birthday. True story. So that is why he decided that he would rather go out for dinner than spend it with you. But okay, I'm not here to judge. But we are wishing him a very, very happy birthday. So that is something I think worth mentioning. Right. But send us your questions anyway, and we will take a look at them and come back to you when we can. Right, let's talk about early detection. We always hear, and you always say, early detection, that saves lives. Why is, particularly with cancer, why is early detection so critical?
So it's the most critical because it finds cancer before the symptoms appear. So when it's small, when it's localized, it's far more likely to be easily or more successfully treated. And if you catch the cancer early, treatments are often less aggressive and more effective, and these dramatically increase your survival rates. So you can improve your quality of life and reduce your long-term healthcare costs. So when found early, cancers can be contained to one area, so there's higher treatment success rate. The localized staging enables us doctors to use either surgical methods or targeted localized treatments to remove or destroy that cancer according to that type of cancer modality. And then, of course, you can have less invasive treatments. So early stage diagnosis means patients can often avoid intensive chemotherapy or radiation, and these treatments are less damaging to your body, leading to fewer side effects, better quality of life, and faster recovery time. So with an early detection, you increase your chance of survival. For example, if you look at breast cancer, it has a 5-year survival rate compared to only for distant stage cancer. So if you've got a cancer that's spread and you've got only a localized lump in the breast, it's got a higher survival rate by detecting that lump before it's spread elsewhere. And even regular screenings that detect precancerous cells, like a Pap smear or a colonoscopy, these are so important because if you catch it early, you nip it in the bud, literally.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
And in terms of screenings, which are the screenings that actually matter and at what age? I mean, it's obviously it's radio, so I'd love to actually see a graph with it, but let's just try and
Okay,
paint
let's
that
do breast
picture
and
for
prostate
people.
differences. So if we look at firstly colorectal cancer, you can prevent cancer by screening and you can remove precancerous polyps. And the general age to start at is 45 years of age. And if it's normal, then every 10 years for a colonoscopy, or more frequently, every 1 to 3 years if there's positive stool-based test that shows that you might have blood in your stools
Or
or
a
a high
family history,
capacity.
maybe.
And then, of course, a family history is very important. And we generally say people should stop around the age of 75 when life expectancy is less than 10 years. There's no reason to do these scopes anymore.
Oi.
With breast cancer, mammograms are the gold standard. They catch breast cancer very early when it's most treatable. And generally, women are advised to start at 40, but they should at least start by the age of 45. And then every year between the ages of 45 to 54, they should have a mammogram. And women older than 55 should have every 1 to 2 years. And they should continue as long as they're in good health and expected to live for at least another 10 years. With regards to cervical cancer, we've spoken about human papillomavirus, HPV, and abnormal cell tests for Pap smears. These are highly, highly effective in preventing cervical cancer. So the guidelines state that women should start from the age of 21 to 25. So it's early,
Very young.
especially with sexually active women because of the risk of HPV. And the frequency is every 3 years or every 5 years at least for an HPV test. And stop at the age after the age of 65 if there's no major risk factors. With lung cancer, we should only screen high-risk patients. So in other words, someone
So
who's
there's no
got a
reason
significant
to.
smoking history, you know, a general person who's got no risk factors, there's no reason to scan them with the lungs. And we're looking at people from the ages of 50 to 80 who have at least what we call a 20 pack year smoking history. A pack year in smoking history, someone smokes 20 cigarettes a day for a year, that's called a pack year. So if they smoke for 20 years, it's called a 20 pack year history. And you can do what we call an annual low dose CT scan so that you don't provide too much radiation when you scan these patients. And then the sort of one that's a bit topical is obviously prostate cancer because there's no must do age. And the reason that is because there's discussion. Some doctors think there's a benefit to screening for prostate cancer, others don't, because most of the time it's a slow growing, indolent cancer that doesn't cause many problems. The age one should start is generally around 50, unless there's a strong family history, then start at the age of 45. But we're talking about people with an average risk at least, not generally somebody who just needs to be tested just for the sake
But
of testing.
the fact that that is a blood test to start for the for PSA, I would imagine makes it there's a much lower barrier to testing. I mean, are there other blood tests, by the way, that we should be doing with your along with your annual checkups from, let's say, the age of 40 or
Well,
whatever
there
it
are
would
for women,
be?
there's well, even for men, there's something called a CEA, which is carcinoembryonic antigen, which is for bowel cancer, which you can do. Remember, none of these tests are 100% sensitive. So just because it's negative doesn't mean it's not going to occur in the future. You can do a CA125, which is for ovarian cancer. You can do a CA143, which is related for breast cancer. You can do a CA199, which is related to pancreatic cancer. All these things are related to certain types of cancers, but you can get false negatives if someone's in what we call diastolic heart failure. It can push up your CA125. That's where the relaxation of the heart in that diastole occurs and the person goes into heart failure. It can push up the levels and you get abnormal levels and it doesn't definitively mean that you've got cancer.
And the symptoms, I mean, what should we be looking out for? What should we never ignore?
So never ignore new or persistent or worsening changes in your body. That's very important. So if you've got an unexplained weight loss of And then you're not on a GLP-1. I
And
was going to say
he
at
looks at me
first,
to say, no, yours is going to
you don't have to understand
unexplain,
how it
right?
works.
Well,
Okay.
please God, yeah.
Okay. If you've got it, you lost at least about 4.5 to 5 kilograms without changes in your diet or exercise.
Or
That's a worry
GLP-1s,
sign.
right?
Extreme fatigue, which is really we're talking about a tiredness that does not improve with rest and interferes with your daily activities. New lumps, new swellings anywhere on the body, especially in the breasts, the testicles, around the neck, armpits, or groin. Those are worrying. Persistent pain, that a chronic pain that doesn't have a clear cause. Unexplained bleeding or bruising, especially if you're coughing up blood or if you've got blood in your stool and your urine that doesn't settle down, or even abnormal vaginal bleeding after menopause. And then, of course, skin changes, new moles or changes to existing ones. We call them asymmetrical or irregular borders or changing of the color of the mole. Those are something that you've got to look at and make sure that those are not growing bigger or changing very quickly. And then you can go more specifically, looking at digestive system. If you've got a change in your bowel habits, so you've got diarrhea followed by constipation, followed by diarrhea, that's a sign that there's something wrong there. It doesn't mean it's cancer, but it needs to be looked into. I mean, respiratory issues, a nagging cough, persistent cough or persistent shortness of breath, hemoptysis, which is coughing up blood. Those are things we worry about. And then there's something we call B symptoms, which is night sweats, when you're drenching the bed and it's not because you're in menopause,
I was just going to say, excluding menopause.
With a cough, with a rash, with enlarged lymph nodes, those are something that you worry about and you need to have them checked out so that they are not ignored and you don't miss out on finding something that you could found much earlier.
Do you think we're over-testing or under-testing?
So I think both are happening at the same time. I think we're over-testing
In
in
certain.
healthy and low-risk populations, but I think we're under-testing as well in socially economic populations that can't afford to be tested. So it's such a sensitive, like tiny kind of slow growing abnormality that you can find, but the body might tolerate it naturally for decades. An example for prostate cancer, it might tolerate it for decades and there won't be any issues about it, but then we end up over investigating. We're doing CAT scans, we're doing MRIs, we're exposing the body to radiation. A lot of the commonly over tested cancers are prostate, thyroid, breast cancers, and they show the highest rate of overdiagnosis. But on the flip side, you don't want to miss a lump in your breast. You don't want to miss a lump in your testicles. These things are really important. So as one gets older, there's a high risk for cancers. But then again, we also say the under-testing comes with social issues, with access barriers, with adherence issues. Some people don't receive enough testing for aggressive cancers that need early intervention. And you can see people standing on the side of the street with large lumps on their face that don't have the means to go have these things tested.
One of the other problems is that we often learn to tolerate what we are living with. I've noticed that with a certain, whatever it would be, you kind of get used to living in a certain way until you realize, hold on, this actually isn't normal. We kind of convince ourselves
Yeah,
because
but
there's slow creep in
I think we
of
convince
that.
ourselves it's not
So,
normal only when it's too late. Because as
exactly.
you're saying, we get into this rut where we're overworking, we're overtired, all the symptoms are coming from this stress and tiredness, and it's not something pathological, it's just something that's time-based. And when I go on holiday, everything will settle down. And by then it could be too late. So you need
So
to
that
listen to your
100%.
body.
I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. We're talking about cancer. We'll be back just after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. We're talking about cancer, and I wanted to move on to treatment. The question, of course, how far we've come. There is reason for hope. I don't want to make it about hype, but let's try and understand. I remember when somebody that I care about was diagnosed with a particularly horrible cancer, you said to me, please don't Google it. And the reason that you said don't Google it is because everything you read is based on stats that actually are outdated because there has been so much progress in term and innovation with regard to the treatment. And that was, I thought, quite interesting because it does give hope about what is being discovered all the time. Can you give us a compare cancer treatments today to 20 years ago? What has changed
So
most?
if we go back 20 years ago, 2006, in those days, this was a one-size-fits-all approach to precision medicine. In other words, in 2006, treatment was reliant on cytotoxic chemotherapies. That was heavy-dose chemotherapy that destroyed your cells, which killed all rapidly dividing cells, including the healthy ones. Today, we can decode specific genetic profiles to tailor a treatment plan unique to that. So I had a friend that had colon cancer many years ago. We're talking about close to 10, 12 years ago. And treatment has changed dramatically since then. At that stage, it was all about surgery and chemotherapy. And it wasn't about the newer things like we're talking about immunotherapy or targeted therapy or precision therapy. And what are those? Immunotherapy is when your own immune system is used to destroy cancer cells. So it's very different to chemotherapy, which was the standard 20 years ago. This can provide a long-lasting, durable response. Target therapies, we have things called monoclonal antibodies, which are very effective in certain types of lung cancers and melanomas. There's radiation therapy that has evolved from a broad two-dimensional X-ray to a highly targeted image-specific guided session that doesn't damage all the cells around it and is adjusted in real time according to AI. That we didn't have many years
Amazing.
ago. There's early detection tools like liquid biopsies. Even the FIT test and the fecal test are very different to what they were 10, 15 years ago. And even now, one of the biggest shifts that we've had since 10 to 15 years ago is palliative care, because palliative care used to only be for people in their last days of their life. Now, palliative care is an integrated treatment, which is a process to manage pain, side effects, and physical and mental well-being. So that's very different to what it was.
Okay, the changes have been quite significant. Are we getting closer to a cure?
We definitely are getting closer to a cure. There's no doubt about it. But I think calling it a cure is the wrong way to look at it, because cancer is not one disease. It's an umbrella term for over 200 distinct conditions. So if you're looking for a single magic bullet, we're definitely getting closer to highly effective personalized treatments that are turning many former fatal cancers into manageable. So in 2026, about 7 out of 10 people survive for at least 5 years after a cancer diagnosis. So they call it a 5-year cancer survival
What
rate
does that
of, if
actually
I'm going to
mean?
explain this, of 70%. So in the late 70s, 80s, it was 50%. In other words, if you've got 100 people, 70 out of the 100 people will survive, whereas 20 years ago, 50 of the 100 people would survive. So for many people now, cancer is actually treated as a manageable chronic illness, which is very different to where it was. And with these revolutionary shifts in the one-size-fits-all chemotherapy, now using immunotherapy, targeted therapy, AI and robotics, these things are very different, and it gives you a different way to treat things. And because tumors are not identical, and because they evolve and mutate constantly, there's sometimes a development of resistance to the drugs that kill them. So we've got to look at all these things. And you've got to follow credible sources like the Mayo Clinic, Sloan Kettering, these type of places that can give you good advice.
So let's break it down. Chemo, radiation, immunotherapy, what these are all just, they all just sound very scary. What are they?
So, in essence, they're different battle strategies for fighting cancer. Some use what we call a carpet bombing approach, while others act as, for lack of a better word, a specialized sniper. So initially, we used to use chemotherapy for everything, and that was your broad attack. And chemotherapy works by providing a very powerful drug, a cytotoxic drug, which is a cell-killing drug, to kill the rapidly dividing cells. And because cancer kills and grows and divides quickly, the chemo would target them. The problem with that was it couldn't always tell the difference between cancer and other fast-growing cells.
Ah.
And that's why people would lose their hair, get problems with the digestive tract, and that's why it caused the often hair loss and the nausea. But it was more of a systemic treatment that traveled through your entire bloodstream to reach cancer cells everywhere in the body. Now we take it one step up and we look at the sniper. And the sniper was your radiation therapy. So the radiation uses high energy beams like X-rays or protons to destroy your cancer cells, and it kills by damaging their DNA and makes them irreparable. The problem is when it kills those cells in a specific spot, it could also damage the tissue around that area. So it's usually used as a local treatment. Then we get to a newer one, which is immunotherapy, and that's like a training program. So the immunotherapy doesn't actually attack the cancer directly. Rather, it helps your own immune system do the job. So we find that cancer often hides from your immune system, and these drugs come around and unmask the cancer cells, or they boost your immune system so they can find and destroy them. The problem, though, is that if your immune system becomes overactive, it might start attacking healthy organs, leading to different types of side effects. And then we get the newest one of them, is which is called targeted therapy, and that's called your locked key syndrome. So that focuses on specific weaknesses of a particular cancer, and that works by targeting specific genes or proteins that allow a cancer to grow and to spread. For example, if a cancer has a specific on switch protein, the therapy will block that switch from switching on. Problem is with that is that it only works for specific cancer that has that target on switch that the drug was made for. So you generally have to do genetic testing to see what is the cancer that you are treating for that. But it aims to leave the healthy cells alone, which is amazing.
Absolutely unbelievable. Okay, so let's talk about also try and understand why outcomes vary so much between patients.
I think this is due to interaction of genetics, biology, environmental, and social factors. And once again, we said cancer is not one single disease. It's a collection of heterogeneous diseases that behave differently in every individual. So even two patients who have the same cancer, like we said, breast cancer, the molecular makeup of their tumors can be completely different. So some tumors are differently driven by different mutations, like your BRCA gene, and that can dictate how aggressive your cancer grows. Other tumors can contain multiple populations of cells with distinct genetic profiles. Once again, they may be sensitive to different type of treatment, while others are resistant. And you've got to look at your patient biology and their health status. In other words, what is the patient's physical strength? Have they got an ability to perform daily tasks? Are they fit? These things dictate and tolerate aggressive treatments for like things like chemotherapy. And I've seen it many times with my patients. Patients who are only treated with chemotherapy, majority of them say that by the end of their treatment, they don't want to do this anymore. It's too much,
Too hard.
too hard. The side effects are too bad. They can't handle it anymore. And that's why the combination of chemo, targeted therapy, immunotherapy, these things are all bound together to help the patient. So you get lower dose of chemotherapy and other types of treatment, which provide less side effects and things like that. And it also depends on whether it's an early diagnosis or a late diagnosis. The earlier the diagnosis, significantly higher survival rate, less treatment necessary. If it's a metastatic spread to other organs,
Much harder.
much harder, more
And what
treatment.
about mental state?
So mental state is very, very pertinent to the conversation, because a person who has cancer can go through all the stages of grief, the anxiety, the stress, the guilt, the depression. Why did this happen to me? Am I okay to be around other people? Am I going to die? Am I going to live? Am I going to have side effects from the medication? There needs to be a holistic approach to someone with cancer with regards to a team-built approach, whether it's with a psychologist, with oncologists, with their specialists, with family to be there to
So it
support
really
it.
is not just from the actual cancer treatment, you're saying chemotherapy, all sorts of other therapies, but actually
psychotherapy
and
therapy, and being
really
there for the
interesting.
patient. I mean, patients.
Which goes back to what we started with, well, how difficult it must have been for people
Yeah.
when they knew how ill they were, but they weren't really ever told. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. We're talking cancer, and we'll be back just after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. This is a pre-record because it's his birthday and he's celebrating, not in studio. But you can still send us your questions on 061-895-1019. Let's remove some of the noise around cancer. So some quick questions, myths. What are the myths that we hear all the time about
So the
cancer?
most problem myth is that every cancer diagnosis is a death sentence. Death rates have dropped significantly since the 1990s, late early 2000s, with a 5-year survival rate being much higher than it was, especially in things like breast cancer, prostate cancer, having survival rates of up to 90% if
Incredible.
caught early.
Right.
So, as I said, many of the cancer treat as chronic, manageable conditions rather than fatal diseases. Another one is the contagious myth. You can't catch cancer like a flu or cold. It's not contagious. It doesn't spread through hugging or kissing or sharing meals. Some cancers we know are linked to HPV, human papillomavirus, or hepatitis, which are contagious, but the cancer itself is not transmitted. Just because you get the virus doesn't mean you're going to get the cancer. The most prevalent ones also the sugar and feeding myth. Eating sugar causes cancer to grow faster. And cutting it out will cure it. So we know that cancer cells do consume more sugar than healthy cells, but not one study out there shows that eating sugar makes cancer
It's
worse
so interesting.
or that quitting sugar makes it disappear. The nuance in all of that, though, is that higher sugar intake can cause obesity, and obesity is a high risk factor for developing different types of cancer. And then, of course, there used to be this old-fashioned myth that if you did a biopsy, like a peritoneal biopsy, that's a biopsy on the abdomen into the peritoneum. If you did a biopsy on that area, you would spread the cancer
Yes,
by
I've
doing
still
the
got that
biopsy.
in my mind that you've got to be very careful about your biopsies because it spreads
So it
cancer.
used to be that exposing a tumor to air or to surgery would cause a spread throughout the body, and that's not true. I mean, surgeons use specialized methods to prevent the cancer cells from migrating during these processes. Another thing is that the alternative cure myth. So herbal products, strict diets, miracle cures can treat cancer better than modern medicine. And this is absolute rubbish. I mean, no herbal care product has ever been proven to cure cancer. Some alternatives can be harmful or interfere with effective evidence-based treatments like chemotherapy. The other thing, which we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, is the positive attitude myth, is if you have a negative attitude, you won't survive
Oh
cancer.
gosh, that's so
And
interesting.
only a positive attitude can cure you. And there's no credible scientific evidence that that is true. So I think if you want to summarize, I think it's early detection is key, lifestyle matters, and support matters.
Okay, and well, we used to call it Dr. Google. Now we say ChatGPT. How dangerous or helpful is that when it comes to cancer?
So it leads to misdiagnosis, unnecessary anxiety, delayed medical treatment, as well as a misinterpretation of your symptoms. I mean, many common benign symptoms like a headache or fatigue are listed as symptoms for various cancers. I mean, how many times have you had a headache and thought you had a brain cancer?
Oh, well, weekly.
That's it's actually a very funny phenomenon. It's actually called cyberchondria. Yeah, look at you. You're not a hypochondriac anymore. You're a
I am a
cyberchondriac.
cyberchondriac. A
No? I like that. I
cyberchondriac.
actually think it's better. Look
It
more.
does suit me more because I don't really think I'm a
Well,
hypochondriac, even
let's not
though
judge ourselves favorably.
no, I definitely have a tendency and a very strong genetic disposition. But all right, very, very interesting. We actually are unfortunately running out of time, but I do want to come back straight off to the break to talk about living with cancer. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. Welcome back to the weekly checkup. We're talking about cancers, and in the interest of time, I'm going to move quite quickly onto it. What is the biggest emotional challenge for patients living with cancer?
So I think we covered it, but it's emotional stress, shock, fear, loss of control. The fear, most important, is the fear of recurrence. So one of the most persistent worries for survivors is the hypervigilance and anxiety that they get that the cancer will return after the treatment ends.
Mm-hmm.
They get a loss of control of their autonomy because their routines are replaced by medical appointments, life-altering decisions, and that existential anxiety and fear of death.
Mm.
You know, as well as that, the fact that they grieve for their old selves in their former health situation, their old physical appearance,
yeah.
how they look.
And it takes up, and it becomes who they are.
They become socially isolated because even when they're surrounded by others, they feel that no one truly understands their experience.
Yeah, that is. And in terms of family, friends, support, what can people best do?
So you've got to blend the emotional presence with a concrete, practical, active plan. And the most effective support often comes from just showing up consistently without placing a burden on coordination for the patient who's ill. So instead of saying, let me know if you need anything, rather target specific tangible tasks like household help, meal coordination, logistics.
Mm.
Emotional support and communication. Be present. Listen without trying to fix, maintain normalcy for them. The cancer doesn't define them. And they'll say, do low pressure check-ins. In other words, send short texts, short messages to say that you're thinking about them, and send them mundane news, like the fact that Liverpool are going to beat Manchester United today. I'm hoping.
Well, actually, well hold on, today,
being Sunday,
today now you've Sunday. Confused just about everybody, because when they're listening to this, they know the result.
So you send them mundane things. And then if something happens that for some reason, like a useless team like United does beat Liverpool, then don't send that to them.
Exactly. It was actually interesting because I'll never forget, I had a very good friend who unfortunately passed away from cancer. And she, I remember speaking to her on the phone a couple of weeks before she passed away. And she said, like, Howard, can we just talk about you? Like, I'm actually so sick of talking about me. And I'm like, I know you want to hear about it, but can we just not talk about it? And like, it really sat with me that.
It's almost like, don't tell the person they've got to be positive. Like, positivity that you tell them, you know, and say, don't be strong.
And they don't have to talk about it all the time.
Because then it pressures the patient to hide the real feelings.
Yeah, yeah. So can people live well with cancer today?
So the answer to that is hell yes.
Mm.
Millions of people are living fulfilling active lives today beyond cancer. There's a shift to chronic living. We've said that there's an extended survival. The five-year survival rate has gone up dramatically from 49% in the 70s to 70% today. We have precision medicine. There's targeted therapies. There's immunotherapies. And these allow patients, even with advanced stages, to live for years with their disease being stable and controlled. Patients are thriving. They're not just surviving. So people get a renewed sense of purpose in their lives. And the key to living well involves a whole holistic person approach that just addresses things more than the actual cancer. So integrative care, as I said, palliative care shouldn't just be for end of life. It should be for maintenance of their time in their life. Healthy lifestyle choices, physical activity, exercise, nutrition, and also allowing the patients to connect with support groups or counselors. Another term we hear is something called scanxiety. So scanxiety is anxiety related to medical scans. And patients go through this when they ever have to go for their checkups. It's like waiting to get your HIV result.
Yeah, because maybe they're going to get a bad result.
So they get scanxiety that is a very big accompaniment of life with cancer.
Three things that you want people to take away from this conversation.
So three things: prevention, early detection, and patient advocacy. If we're talking about prevention, 30 to 50% of all cancers are preventable through lifestyle modifications. Tobacco cessation, health and weight and activity, dietary choices like prioritizing plant-based diet rich in fruits and vegetables, limiting processed meats, vaccinations, getting vaccinated against HPV and hepatitis B. Then early detection. Cancer is most treatable and often curable when it's caught in its early stages. Regular screenings, mammograms, pap smears, colonoscopies, skin checks. These things are mandatory before these lesions become invasive, and have symptom awareness. And then lastly, patient advocacy and education. Empower yourself with knowledge. Ask the right questions. understand your family's medical history, so you've got a high understanding if you have a genetic risk for certain cancers. And then ask questions when you go and see your oncologist. What is my diagnosis?
Don't be
Is it a
afraid.
stage?
Do
Is it a
not be
three?
afraid to ask.
What are my treatment options? And
And
speak with them.
can I just add one more thing? When you go to your oncologist, take somebody with you who will listen and even make notes and remember different parts of what you're saying.
Because that period when you're sitting in that office, your life is flashing before you. You're not hearing anything. You're not hearing what you need to hear. So you hear snippets and you miss out on crucial bits of information.
That is all we have time for. I'm Howard Feldman, Dr. Anton Meiberg, wishing you a very, very happy birthday. Enjoy the day and just all the best for the year ahead. We'll be back with you next week for the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg.